shape of the room is changing because of the screen. Moving around. That's good.
Okay, so I guess we can might as well just plunge into it. So now I know what it feels like to be Ajahn Brahm. I just come straight from the committee meeting, straight to the sutta classes, one thing after the other. So I hope my brain still works reasonably well to see what happens as we go along here. So okay. So today's sutta is going to be the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And in many ways, this is probably one of the most important. Actually, there is no such thing as the most important, but it certainly is an important sutta. And it is quite distinct, quite different in many ways from the other suttas. So first of all, I just talk a little bit in general about this sutta and how it is different. And for that reason, why it is also interesting here, because of that difference compared to the other suttas. In English here, it's translated as the Great Passing Away. So it is basically about the Buddha's last journey towards Kusinara, where he passed away. And it talks about that journey, starting in Rajagaha, the capital of Magadha, and the Buddha's voyage all the way to his last resting place, where he then passes away under the sal trees in Kusinara, which is kind of a small little place out in the north of the Ganges River. So the reason why this is interesting is there's many reasons for that. One of the reasons why this is interesting, because it is about the Buddha's last journey. You can imagine the kind of things the Buddha will be talking about on his last journey, right? He will be laying down his legacy. He will be saying, giving instruction to the Sangha, what they should be doing, how they should be practicing after he's passed away. One of the very interesting things when a spiritual, genius, a master like that, who is so important for the whole workings of Buddhism or for a particular religion, when they pass away, it leaves a massive gap, right? It's a big hole in the system. And we can see this as we move on into the sutta, how people obviously are very distraught by the idea of the Buddha passing away. So because of that, he needs to kind of lay down some guidelines. What are we going to do from now on? How are we going to be able to survive? How should we deal with the Dhamma and the Vinaya after the Buddha has passed away? So all of that is in there, right? These are things that are quite different from the things that we normally talk about. And for that reason, they are interesting here. Another reason why they're interesting is because one of the things the Buddha does here, of course, is to define also what the Dhamma is. What actually is the Dhamma that he has taught? It is, you have all the suttas, and you think you're not sure where to start reading because there's so many of them. So it's good to have some ideas from the Buddha himself, what he considers the core aspect of his own teachings, what we should really focus on, where it is important to put our attention. Right? So again, this is very, very interesting. And then how the Sangha is run, how the Buddhism Dhamma should be run after the Buddha's passing away. All of these things are very, very fascinating. So here are the kind of the famous last words, if you like, of the Buddha before he passes away. All the kind of important stuff is, in a sense, collected here into this particular sutta. So this is one reason why it is interesting. Another reason is because it is the longest sutta in the whole Sutta Pitaka. There's no solo sutta longer than this one. It's 60 pages. I promise not to read all the 60 pages today, because if I did, I'd be sacked by Ajahn Brahm and I would never come back here again. It is long, and the reason why it is so long is because it's not really a sutta at all. Usually a sutta is a particular teaching of the Buddha, right? He talks about the gradual training. He talks about the Four Noble Truths. He talks about some aspect of the Dhamma, and he gives either a brief explanation or an expanded explanation or whatever. But usually there's a maximum length to those suttas, maybe up to 10 pages or whatever. But this here is not a sutta, it's biographical material. It's a large part of this this thing is the biography of the Buddha. What happens as he moves from starting from Rajagaha and all the way till he passes away. So it's not the voice of the Buddha. This is the voice of a narrator, right? Somebody is observing the events. Somebody is collecting the information afterwards. Right? It's afterwards. And this is one of those things is that the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is one of the few suttas we can know with absolute certainty was finished or completed after the Buddha passed away. This is not a story and the reason we know that is because some of the aspects of this sutta actually goes beyond the lifetime of the Buddha. So for that to get in there, obviously, it would have to be collected after the Buddha passed away. And this gives you some idea that to always remember that there are certain teachings in the suttas that we can ascribe to the Buddha with more certainty, and there are other teachings that have less certainty to them, which are obviously not from the Buddha. And this sutta makes it very clear that that has to be the case. And of course, this is what the narrative is all about. The narrative is precisely the sort of thing that would often have been added afterwards. And then interspersed in that narrative, you find then these little teachings by the Buddha kind of combined with this narrative. And it is interesting, if you look at the narrative aspect of the suttas, it says in the first council after the Buddha passed away, and then when they collected his teachings, etc., one of the things they ask at that council is, where was the sutta spoken? Who was it spoken by? Right? So, in other words, at that time, when the first council was held, there was no narrative yet. There was no narrative context. If you remember the way the suttas are always structured, it starts off by saying, at such and such a time, the Buddha was staying in such and such a place, talking to such and such a person. And then the Buddha said, and then comes what the Buddha actually spoke. So all that narrative, all that initial information, and all the closing information, it says in the discourse or in the Vinaya part on the first council, it specifically says that was added afterwards. Mahakasapa asked Venerable Ananda, where were the sutta spoken? The Samanyapala Sutta, who spoke it? Who was the protagonist and that kind of stuff? So it is directly said that this was actually added afterwards. And that's why the narrative material is always secondary to the word spoken by the Buddha himself. Another kind of interesting part as well about this sutta is that it is really, as I said, not really a sutta. And in other schools of Buddhism, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta is found in the Vinaya. Right? It's found in the rules of the monks, which is kind of strange, right? How come that is the case? And the answer is that if you look at the Vinaya Pitaka, that too starts off with the life story of the Buddha, but from the moment of awakening and then onwards, whereas this is when he passed away. So the whole Vinaya in almost all the schools is framed around, the frame for the Vinaya is actually the life story of the Buddha. So it may have been that the Mahaparinibbana Sutta was originally part of the Vinaya Pitaka, because it's not really a sutta in ordinary sense. And there's a kind of grey overlap there. And the Vinaya is often a little bit later than the suttas when it was spoken. So you can see how that kind of matches quite well there. It doesn't really make much difference, but it explains why such an unusual sutta actually occurs in the Sutta Pitaka rather than perhaps somewhere else. Okay, so that is just a little bit of background for you, just to get some idea what this discourse is all about. So this is going to be slightly different from the ordinary suttas. My idea is to kind of do this over separate Sundays. And hopefully by 2020 or something, we'll be finished with this sutta. That's kind of my plan. So I don't have any kind of sense of urgency with this. So whenever we finish, we finish. So we'll see how things go. Okay, so let's start having a look at this and see where this gets us. So as always, you're welcome to ask questions as we go along, so we can take those in our stride. Okay, so this is Maurice Walsh's translation, which is a very nice translation. I don't know if you are all that familiar with the Digha Nikaya. Very rare that we do suttas from the Digha Nikaya. But they will see the language here is quite different. The language is quite easy language, quite informal compared to some of the other translations. Thus have I heard, once the Lord was staying at Rajagaha on the mountain called Vulture's Peak. Now just then King Ajatasattu, Videhiputta of Magadha, wanted to attack the Vajjayans. He said, I will strike the Vajjayans who are so powerful and strong. I will cut them off and destroy them. I will bring them to ruin and destruction. Sounds quite violent, doesn't it? So no messing around. This kind of, he was a king. This was the stuff kings do, I suppose. Of course, here we are on Mount Vulture Peak, and that famous little—it's really a hill. It's not really a mountain. It's a kind of a small hill, really, in Rajagaha. And if you go to India today, you will again you can go to Mount Vulture Peak, and you can kind of see the vulture shape of that mountain when you go there. And I recommend you, if you ever go to India, I would recommend you to go to Rajagaha and go to the Vulture's Peak. It's quite beautiful. It's one of the most secluded places in India on the pilgrimage tour. The vast number of places you go today, they have been really touristified, right? I think the Indian government has kind of figured out they can make a few quick bucks on the Buddhist pilgrims. So it's becoming very touristified and really built up. And I think it's good on the Indian government, of course, to do that, because it makes it more accessible to Buddhists in some ways. But it also means it becomes very busy sometimes. Lots of people, lots of noise, lots of music, lots of chanting, right? One group chanting, another one playing the drums, a third one doing prostrations, a fourth one chanting in a different language, and everything going on at the same time. Especially when you go to Bodh Gaya, it's a little bit like that. It's this cacophony of sounds going on. But Vulture Peak is different in that sense. It's very secluded on the hill outside the city. So when you go there, you get a little bit of feeling, I think, what it would have been like at the time of the Buddha. So in that sense, it's actually quite different from these other places. So I would, it's actually quite nice. You can go there early in the morning, you can sit in meditation, you can feel the peace. It has those roughly, perhaps, the same qualities that it had at that time. So very, very nice. And it's quite inspiring also to go to a place, right? You read about Mount Vulture's Peak in the Sutta, and then you go there, it actually exists. There was one of those things that I found was so eye-opening when I started off doing these pilgrimages. And when you read about it in the suttas, it's kind of like a story, almost like a fairy tale. You're not really sure whether it's how true it is or what's going on. But then you go there and you read the suttas and you see how the description here matches up with the reality on the ground, right? You go to another place in Rajagaha called the Hot Springs Park, which is talked about in the suttas. The monks would go there to the hot spring park. They would kind of, you know, have a bath or whatever. And sometimes they would have a bath inappropriately because the king would come. And the king also wanted to have a bath. That's actually quite an interesting one because it shows you how low profile the kings were in those days. I'll talk about that more in a second. And then the monks wouldn't go out. So then the king would complain to the Buddha, the monks are keep holding me for my bath, you know, for a long period of time. And then you go to the same place, right, now, go to the same hot springs park, and lo and behold, people are still bathing in exactly the same springs 2,500 years later. This is the really nice thing about India, the sense of timelessness that is really powerful. You know, you go to places, and the description you find in the suttas, it's still almost exactly the same. In the suttas, it says that if you go to Benares, to Varanasi, it is a place you go to get good cloth, right? If you were wealthy or whatever, you go to Benares to get the cloth from there because they have the best cloth. You go to Benares today, is one of the cloth capitals of India to the present day. And you kind of think, whoa, you know, these suttas actually are this. It kind of draws you into the Dhamma. It makes it so much real. The Buddha is a real historical personage. He's not some artificial, fictitious character. He's the real thing. And it makes it very, very real for you. At least it does for me. And I think you may find the same when you see these things. And so that is the Vulture Peak Mountain. And then, of course, the king in Rajagaha at that time was King Ajatasattu. He was the king of the Magadhan country. At this time, it was a large country by Indian standards of the time, but not very large compared to how things developed later when Magadha became a massive empire. It was still quite small at this time. I don't know how to compare it with a modern country. Maybe it would have been roughly the size of, Thailand. Maybe not quite as large as Thailand, but, that's just a ballpark figure to give you some idea. The king there was King Ajatasattu. The name Ajatasattu means the unborn enemy. Right? So probably when the previous king's queen, when she was pregnant or whatever, then it's kind of weird that somebody should have a name like that, right? The unborn enemy. You wonder whether it is a real name or whether it is some kind of epithet that maybe arose after the fact or whatever. And the reason why he was known as the unborn enemy was because he ended up killing his father, right? So here is a father, you bring a child into the world and they end up killing you. Which of course, from a Buddhist point of view, is one of the worst things you can do in this world. And that is a very common theme, apparently, in Indian kingship in general. Often you will have, from one generation to the next one, you have the son killing the father. So Ajatasattu's son in turn, whose name was, what was his name again? I forget now, but anyway, he also ends, Udayabhadra, that's right, Udayabhadra, he ends up killing his own father, and then his son again killing his own father, right? So kind of going down the generations, from one generation to the next one. We often talk about the bad character traits of people being inherited, right? You do the same thing as your mother and father did, and this is exactly what's happening here. And it's very interesting to read about the kingship in India at that time. King Ajatasattu's father was the famous King Bimbisara, and he was supposed to become a stream enter after meeting the Buddha. But just to have a look at how these kings actually lived is quite fascinating, because it shows you a little bit about, gives you an idea of the size of these kingdoms, of the amount of people that were there, the amount of power that these kings had. One of the things you find in the suttas about Bimbisara is that there is an origin story behind some of the monks' rules. And according to this origin story, one of the monks, he went to the woodyard of the king, right? And when he went to the woodyard of the king, he said to the guardsman there, "Well, the king has given me all the wood," right? And then he takes all the wood in the king's woodyard and he builds himself a kuti. Right? So, of course, it was completely wrong by this monk, and this is why the rule came later on. A parajika, he wasn't really stealing because it was given to him, but he was tantamount to stealing here. But imagine the king's woodyard, right? This is the woodyard that is meant for the building of the city, for the upkeep of the city, for use in case of accidents or something falls down. The entire woodyard disappeared because he was going to build himself a single kuti. Right, a kuti is like 2 by 3 meters, right? 2 by 3 meter kuti, hut for the monk. All the king's wood was used up for that. So it's tiny, right? Imagine the size of that city. Remember the buildings that we are talking about here are buildings that are in large part, they would be built of wood. At the very least, they would have a framework of wood. There might be wattle and daub on the outside, but there would be a wooden framework inside. A lot of the rafters and the roof structure would be made of wood. The gates of the city would often be wooden. This was before they started using stone. There's no archaeological record of any stone usage in India prior to about 250 BC. That's when it started. Everything before that was wooden. Right? The entire city was supplied by a woodyard which contained enough wood to build one kuti here. So that gives you an idea of the scale of things at that time. And this is very interesting here, because when we can place that in an historical context, then we can look at how things developed over time. And it gives us some idea of when this must have happened historically here. It gives us an historical picture of what's going on there. So that is one example, right? But the other example, tiny, tiny. The other example is I was talking about before, about the bathing here. So here is the monks are bathing in the hot springs, and then the king comes, and the king's kind of is bathing in the same hot spring. The king goes to the hot springs to bathe, right? It's another one of those kind of little things which is kind of surprising. You think that the king would have his personal bath attendant with his own personal bath, but no, he also goes to the hot springs to bathe. Then later on, in that same story I was just talking about this monk getting all the wood from the king's woodyard, later on he just goes to the king's residence. It's not even called a palace, it's like a residence. And he goes there and he just sits down, the king's come and bows to him, and then they have a conversation together about what happened. Right? Everything seems very, very small scale. And this is the idea you really get throughout these most ancient suttas, that things are very small. There's nothing much really, there's no kind of, everything is very simple and very small. And the king is more like a headman of a village or a headman of a town, or at the very most, a headman of a small city, than really being what we think of as, you know, kings today, king of Thailand, Queen Elizabeth, this sort of thing, which is on a very, very large scale. So I would guess, just reading, just guesstimating from what is going on here, I would say that even in the capital city of Magadha, one of the biggest kingdoms of the day, I would say probably a few thousand people live there at the most, right? Maybe 10,000, maybe 20,000. You want to take over? You want to? Okay. So small, very small scale. And this, the reason why this is so interesting, and it gives us some idea of the history of things, is that there are some descriptions of what happened later on. If you then move on to maybe about 300 BC, right? The Buddha, these days, the best estimates for when the Buddha passed away is about 400 BC, and then going back 80 years of being born, maybe 480 BC. That is a commonly accepted figure these days. If you go forward 100 years, you come to that time, a very different time in India, and you can read about this time through historical records that have been preserved by some of the ancient Roman historians, right? We're moving now into Europe, into Rome. And the Roman historians, because they were very keen on history and that sort of thing, and they preserved ancient records of what happened from Greece and all of these kind of things. And one of those records is from a Greek ambassador. He was an ambassador to the India at that time, which was the great empire of Chandragupta. This was prior to Ashoka. And so he was sent by one of the Greek kings to India to be the ambassador there. And his name was Megasthenes, right? And because he was Greek, he came from a very different culture, he would write everything down, right? The Indians weren't so interested in writing things down, but he wrote everything down. So he has all these descriptions about the capital of that empire, which then was Magadha. And that capital was now called Pataliputra. No mention of Rajagaha or anything like that. Now it was called Pataliputra. And that is present-day Patna in India. So when you go to Patna, you're actually stepping into history there right away. And the way he writes about Pataliputra as this magnificent capital, right, with massive walls. These were still wooden walls, but walls going all the way around the city. And the size he's talking about was several kilometers in both directions. So a very, very large and very splendid city with a magnificent palace in the middle for the king. And he talks about the area that was ruled by this empire. He talks about the distances and everything. And basically that empire at this stage already was covering the vast majority of what is present-day India, and some of it even beyond that. Right? So the cities, you can see here, there's been some massive change from the time of the Buddha. That would have happened maybe at the most 150 years before. Now suddenly we have this enormous capital in India, something that didn't even exist at the time of the Buddha. Pataliputra, if you try to find Pataliputra in the suttas, it doesn't even occur. It doesn't really occur in the early suttas. This is one of the things I will show you as well as we go through this sutta, is that here is one of the places where it is mentioned. It is mentioned by the name Patali Gama. Gama means village. So when the Buddha was about to pass away, this was just a small village on the river Ganges. Then, 100 years later, after Buddha passed away, it has already been transformed into a massive capital. And we know that from historical records. So this gives you an idea of the historical position of the suttas, right? And it gives you, it fits very well with the fact that the Buddha existed at least 100 years before this massive empire started in India. It fits very well with that. It almost sounds as if the Buddha might have even been earlier, because the transformation is quite astonishing from a small fishing village to a magnificent capital of an empire. So this is how you can see the history in action here. You can see the place of the suttas in history almost quite literally. In another place in the Mahapanibbana Sutta, the Buddha is about to pass away at Kusinara, and Ananda says to him, "Oh, please, please don't pass away in this kind of God-forsaken village." Now, they wouldn't use the word God-forsaken, because they, I guess, as Buddhists, they would have been very God-forsaken anyway, but they, you know, this little village, right, in the midst of nowhere, far away in the jungle, don't pass away here. Instead, pass away in one of the great cities of India. Great cities of India, Vaisali, Champa, Rajagaha, Savati, Kosambi, and Saketa. These were the six cities. No mention of Pataliputra at all. It was just a fishing village at the time. So again, you can see how this fits in very nicely. So this is some of the interesting things that this kind of information, it helps us to place Buddhism in history, to understand that it actually fits in with the continuum of history. It's not some kind of random information that's collected in the suttas. It fits in with the flow of history as it's moving forward and changing into the future. Right? It makes you feel very confident that these suttas are onto something. That it's not, these things have been remembered correctly, because everything fits together very nicely in this jigsaw puzzle we might call history here. Okay. So so that is the king, right? Just a little bit of discussion about the king there. And the capital cities that he had, and how small everything was at that time compared to how things were very soon afterwards. How the idea of kingship really evolved from very small scales to something very massive very soon afterwards. So this is the first part here. The second thing in this sentence, which is also interesting, is that he says he wants to invade, to attack the Vajrayans. This is another little word of history. We're talking history again now. The Vajrayan Republic was north of the River Ganges, whereas the Magadhan Republic was just south of the River Ganges. They were very close. They had a common border, and the border was the river itself, and a very long common border. Now, the Vajrayans were very strong, a very proud republic, had one of the great cities in India at that time called Vaisali, and the Buddha often stayed in Vaisali. He stayed in the, what was it called, the wood there, the dark Andavana, dark, was it dark wood? Mahavana, I think, was the great wood in the Kutagara Sala, which is the house with the peaked roof. And that was one of the Buddha's main places of staying when he stayed in Vaisali in the Vajrayan Republic. So it was a proud republic, a strong republic, right? And here King Ajatasattu is saying, I want to conquer these ones. And he uses this very kind of violent language to say how he wants to conquer the Vajrayans. And again, this is also very interesting, because again, this is something you can also place in a historical context. Right, we're talking about a country with a continent with many, many small kingdoms, and we're seeing warfare. We're seeing how some of these republics want to conquer other of the republics. We can almost see the seeds here of some kind of historical change. Right, this is what we can see here. So, if we step back a little bit and we look at the earliest sources we have for this kind of historical change. Some of the very earliest things is where the Magadhan Republic and the Angan Republic, the Angas is the republic to the east of Magadha. And the capital there was Champa, one of the other great cities of India at that time. Now that kingdom, it seems that it had already been conquered by King Bimbisara. King Bimbisara was the father of King Ajatasattu, right? So that had already been conquered. So in the Vinaya, it's very often talked about Anga Magadha as a combined kingdom. So what we are seeing here, we're seeing the beginning of the expansion of the Magadhan kingdom, starting to expand, starting from a fairly small core, maybe, as I said before, half the size of Thailand or something like that, maybe even smaller, starting to incorporate the republics around it, starting to expand. The second step in this expansion is when you read the suttas that King Ajatasattu, he is at war with his uncle. His uncle is King Pasenadi of Kosala, who was the other big kingdom at that time, also to the north of the Ganges, but a little bit further west, a little bit more towards Delhi and that side, Varanasi. And that had the capital of Savatthi. And they would often fight over, what would they fight over? They fought over Benares, right? Kasi. Kasi was a very famous trading port. It had some of the great luxury goods of India at the time, and it was considered very valuable for that reason. And the kings would get all their luxury goods from Kasi. So would fight over Kasi, fight over Benares to incorporate that into the kingdom. And eventually, after Benares kind of going back and forth between these kings a few times, eventually it ended up in the hands of King Ajatasattu. Right? So here you can see the expansion, right, of the Indian Empire, of this, how the Magadhan Empire is expanding, first to the east, then to the west, towards these other parts of expanding out, becoming a much larger empire than it was before. You see the gradual expansion, like one kingdom is becoming powerful and starting to exert control over everything else. And here, in this particular sutta, we're seeing the next stage in that, right? Now they have expanded, looked from east to west. Now they're also looking towards the north. How can we also expand to the north of the river Ganges to expand our kingdom even more? This is the next stage. So again, you can see how this fits into the historical context. And then later on, according to later sources, he also fought with the Kosalan kingdom, which then is further to the west, and expansion continuing here. Now, if you go forward in history again, the earliest sources, historical records that we have, that we know, are fairly secure in history because they have multiple references and this sort of thing, is the Nanda dynasty. The Nanda dynasty is a dynasty that came, if you start with Ashoka, most people know who Ashoka is. So Ashoka was about 265 BC when he was coronated, became king. His father was called Bindusara, and he was reigning that same empire maybe for very uncertain 15, 20 years. And his father again was Chandragupta, also quite a famous emperor of India. And that was Chandragupta, that was where Megasthenes, I mentioned before, was the ambassador from Greece. And prior to that, you have the Nandan dynasty. And we know about the Nanda dynasty from multiple sources. We know it from Indian sources. But we also know about the Nanda dynasty from external sources. Alexander the Great, right, he came to India and he invaded the northwest of India. This is around the Indus Valley. He invaded that about 325 BC. Right? And he talks about King Nanda, who was so powerful and so fearful. He was in this place far away, right? But his troops mutinied. They wouldn't want to go any further because the rumors of the power of King Nanda was so terrifying that they didn't want to go any further. And they mutineered, or whatever it's called, and they decided to go back to Greece rather than continuing on this fight with this incredibly powerful king. So here already, and his empire would then have stretched roughly almost to the Indus Valley. That's why they would have heard about him. And then we have another source, a rock carvings, which are found on the other side of India in a place called Kalinga, which talks about the massive waterways, waterworks that was done by King Nanda, Mahananda. Also would have been the same Nanda who brought water either to or from Kalinga somehow from the Magadhan Empire. So these are the first historical records we have of this. Would have been about 325 BC. We are within a few decades, right, of the life of the Buddha. And the transformation in India, again, is astonishing. It is a transformation. Now we're talking about an empire that stretches almost across the entire width of India. India is a very, very large country. East to west in the north, we're talking about several thousand kilometers, right? It's not as large as Australia, but still very, very large. Talking about a very large sphere. And if that had developed in a few decades, maybe say 7 or 8 decades after the Buddha's passing away, from the small Magadhan Republic, had expanded and expanded and expanded until it was this massive empire. So again, you can see how the suttas fit in to the historical reality. You see the expansion in the suttas from very small republics beginning, and then a few decades we have no information, and the other side of those decades it emerges as a massive empire ruled from Pataliputra, which was always at that point the capital city of Magadha, right? So again, this historical continuity, which gives you a very strong sense that the suttas are part of a larger historical context again. So maybe, I hope I'm not boring you with this, but I find this very interesting because it kind of makes things so real to me. These are real events, these are real people. The Buddha, Venerable Ananda, Venerable Sariputta, these were real people who fit in to a larger historical context, some of which we have sources from far, far away, all the way from Europe. We have sources to verify. Some of them are the rock carvings in India itself, coming together in a very nice way. And that's why I find all of this very interesting and exciting, frankly, because it makes things very real in a way which otherwise may be difficult to extract from these things. And this is one of the reasons why I say this sutta is interesting, right? Because some of this information is available here, and we'll have a more look at that as we go along. Yes, please. No, he's not second clan at all. Cleanse it? No, King. What's his name again? Vidudaba. He was the son of King Pasenadi of Kosala, and he was the one who did to destroy the Sakyans, according to later records. So that was the son of King Kosala, yeah. That is uncertain. It's found in the commentaries. It is quite possible that it is based on certain historical records, because otherwise why would it be there, right? And the story there is that the Sakyans, very proud people, you know the story behind that? I'll tell it just for everyone else's sake. The story behind that is that King Pasenadi of Kosala, he asked for a Sakyan princess to be married to his son, right? And the Sakyans being very proud, because the Sakyans were a small part of the big Kosala empire, but they were like an independent kingdom within the larger empire. They were like a vassal state, basically. And he asked, and the Sakyans were too proud to give them a real princess. They said, "Oh, we take this slave girl and we pretend she's a princess." And she was kind of half princess, half. She was kind of on the mother's side. I think she was a slave. On the father's side, she was more the real thing or whatever. And then later on, he found out, and that's when he found out that he had married a slave girl. He became so irate. He wanted to completely destroy the entire Sakyan clan. So he was not a Buddhist, I think. I think that's fair to say. So that's what happens if you upset kings. Be careful what you do with kings, right? If you meet a king, be careful, because especially in those days, they were almighty, basically, do whatever they wanted. So that is quite a bit of history for you. So I does that make sense to everyone? So I hope you haven't come here to hear about the Four Noble Truths, because if you are, this is kind of a little bit sidetracked from that. But nevertheless, I think interesting still here. So again, please ask as we go along here. So now I will move along, and now we will quickly get into a few Dhamma points, which of course is what we really want to get to, because that is even more, far more interesting than history. But sometimes a bit of history can be exciting as well here. Okay. So he says all of these things, right, about the Vajrayans, how he will destroy them and annihilate them, etc. And one may wonder whether that's a bit over the top. It sort of sounds like it's a bit over the top. Sometimes when you read the suttas and you read the parallel versions, you see the differences. And there is a Sanskrit version of this Panibbana Sutta, which I had a quick look at before I came in here. And that actually is even more expansive on how he was really going to kill these people, right? So you can see how these kind of things often tend to get expanded, because probably nobody was really present, so they're kind of just having to guess roughly at what he was saying. Okay, so we go move on now. King Ajatasattu said to his chief minister, the Brahmin Vasakara, Brahmin, go to the Blessed One, worship him with your head to his feet in my name. Ask if he is free from sickness or disease, if he is living at ease vigorously and comfortably, and then say, Lord, King Ajatasattu Videhiputta of Magatha wishes to attack the Vajrayans and says, I will strike the Vajrayans who are so powerful and strong. I will cut them off and destroy them. I will bring them to ruin and destruction. So this is the chief minister of Magadha, Brahmin Vasakara. We will meet him later on again. He was obviously one of the most powerful people at that time. And the Brahmins already were kind of becoming strong. The king himself would have been a Kshatriya, the Kshatriya caste, which was the noble caste, the administration caste, or also the soldier caste. The Brahmins obviously also having powerful positions here in the administration. So he sends off this Brahmin. And interesting, right, that he is supposed to ask the Buddha about this. It's kind of weird, you know, I'm going to go and ask the Buddha about, I'm going to attack, I'm going to destroy these people and see what the Buddha says about it. He would have thought, you know, tell me how to watch the breath, or, you know, how do I understand the five precepts maybe, that kind of makes sense. But this is what we're seeing here. And fascinating, isn't it? Did this actually happen? Do people actually ask the Buddha about how to go to war? Is that kind of reliable information? And I think the answer is very hard to say. It is possible that this is not what happened, that this is a setting up, a meeting between the Buddha and this Brahmin. And of course, the content of that meeting is what really matters. This is, again, the narrative framework is not so important. So perhaps it didn't quite happen that way. But perhaps it did. Right? If you were a very smart king, I can very well imagine that you would want to go to the Buddha just to see what he has to say. Because Buddha's probably, usually when the Buddha speaks, he says something interesting, right? So maybe you get some kind of information that can be useful, whatever that information might be. So maybe if you are a really kind of clever king, you might actually do that still. It is a possibility, I think, although it does seem a little bit strange to have that kind of question. I don't think, nobody has ever come to me and asked me how, you know, I really want to kill this person. How should I go about doing that? It hasn't happened to me yet, and I hope it never happens. Well, maybe it's good if it happens, because then I can kind of dissuade them perhaps, you know. But anyway, so this is really what the question is here. Okay, so, and he replies, very good, sire, said Vasakara. And having had the state carriages harnessed, he mounted one of them and drove in state from Rajagaha to the Vulture's Peak, riding as far as the ground would allow, then continuing on foot to where the Lord was. He exchanged courtesies with the Lord, then sat down to one side and delivered the king's message. So, this is a standard way that this is described in the suttas. The kings or the famous people, they kind of get all the good carriages together and they kind of drive in state. In state means like with all the pomp of royalty, that sort of stuff, right? That's what it kind of refers to. And one of the little interesting points about this here, it's a very small one, but nevertheless it kind of sort of interesting, it always says that you ride those carriages to a certain point. And beyond that point, you have to get off and you have to walk on foot after that point. Right? And I think the point about that is to show us that the monasteries at that time, they were always secluded. They could not be approached fully by any kind of vehicle. Right, so maybe what we should do at Bodhinyana is to cut out the driving into the monastery, take away the bitumen, people have to walk into the monastery. How far should they have to walk? Okay, not too far, otherwise we won't be eating anything, so not too far. But it's nice, right? It reminds you that these were forest monasteries. They were in the wilderness. They were not fully accessible by vehicles. You had to walk to get there. That's a beautiful reminder. And one of the things I want to point out later on is precisely the importance of that in the suttas. The idea of wilderness lodgings, lodgings in the forest, is a very important part of how Buddhism was set up in the early days. And sometimes it is so important that we remember these early ideals, right? We forget about them. We move in a completely different direction. We get trapped in the history of Buddhism and we are kind of sitting at the end of 2,500 years of history and we are conditioned by all of that rather than being conditioned by what Buddhism actually was like in the early days. And sometimes we need to extract ourselves from all that baggage of history and ask ourselves, how was it actually practiced in the early days? Extract ourselves from all the cultural and historical baggage and then try to be more authentic, because that's when you get the results. There is a reason why the Buddha laid these things down in the way that he did. So, then he goes to the Buddha, exchanges courtesies with the Buddha, right? It's one of those very nice things. You meet the Buddha, you say a few pleasantries, right? Like we said before, asking about whether you are well, whether you are in good health, right? Are you living at ease? How do you have any illnesses? And he said, oh, my back is a bit painful. It's interesting, the Buddha's back was a bit painful towards the end. I don't know if he ever complained about it, but it is certainly described that way in the suttas. So also a nice little touch, right? There's a human touch there. An important element, I think, because it's important to understand that sometimes as a monastic you might try to live up to an ideal that never actually existed. There should be a human touch to all of these things. There should be a sense of friendliness and kindness, right? There shouldn't be this kind of supreme aloofness whereby there is no friendliness anymore and all you teach is like Abhidhamma or something like that. And then it becomes incredibly dry and very kind of aloof and removed from ordinary human emotions and human feelings. Makes it very inhumane perhaps in some ways. So these little things actually matter. It says something about what is the right way of doing things. And then he delivered the message, right? He told the Buddha about how the king wants to attack the Vajjayans, etc., etc. And then comes the Buddha's answer, right? The Buddha is now going to reply to this. And you might have thought that the Buddha would have said, go away, I don't want to answer questions like that. No, the Buddha does not say that. In fact, what the Buddha does, he talks about, we will see that in a second, what he has told the Vajjayans previously. Why is it that the Vajjayans are so strong? Why is it that they are so powerful? He tells this Brahmin the secret to the strength of the Vajjayans. And you might think, that must undermine the Vajjayans completely, right? The Buddha is telling you all the strengths, then they will know how to attack them, and that will be the end of it. Why does the Buddha do that? It's almost as if the Buddha would like the Magadhan Empire to kind of expand and kind of engulf everything else. And I always used to be puzzled about that, because it seemed to me that here the Buddha was almost kind of giving up the Vajrayans into the hand of the Magadhans, so the Magadhan Empire could expand. Right? But I think that is probably a wrong reading of this. That's not really what is going on. What is going on here is that the Buddha is telling these things just as a matter of fact. This is, you know, how you become a strong republic. And possibly what he's doing is just trying to either to turn the king off, saying they're way too strong, you can't really attack them anyway, or he's trying to show the king, this is how you should lead a kingdom, right? These are the right principles. The principles are not principles of war or aggression, but principles of friendliness, how to work together, how to cooperate, how to use the Dhamma, etc., in your as part of your rulership as a king. This may be, I think, what he's trying to tell King Ajatasattu. And then hopefully, maybe he's hoping that the king will then kind of chill and say, yeah, you have a point, I shouldn't really be attacking, right? I should just kind of lead the royal life in the right way. Of course, that's not what happens. What happens is that the king, he just does actually attack you. But I think this is probably what's going on with the Buddha here. He's just trying to do his best to keep the peace, at the same time telling how it is that these Vajrayans are so strong. So, just a little point there, because it seems strange in a way that the Buddha should be giving away the secrets of the Vajrayans and almost giving them up into the hands of the Magadhan king. Please, yeah. That's a good point, actually. That's true. Certainly what's happening there. Maybe that is significant. Maybe that there's some significance to that. What exactly is that significance, though? Maybe it is precisely that he doesn't really want to. I'm not telling you the secret. I'm telling you kind of what is going on in this other kingdom, and it's not really meant to be used in the wrong way. Maybe there's something undercurrent like that perhaps going on there. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It is kind of slightly strange, isn't it? I'm not sure what really to make of that, to be honest. But usually the Buddha talks to people fairly directly. He doesn't actually kind of go in roundabout ways. So, yeah. 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 He may have had died already. Yeah. Quite possibly. Yeah. So we're talking maybe about 6 months before the Buddha passed away, something like that. Maybe even less, because he spent the reins in Vaisali and then he continued after that. So maybe something 4 to 6 months before the Buddha passed away. So things were already disintegrating here. Say again. Yeah, exactly. So the military may have been strong, but I think also they were probably very unified and they were working very well together. Very often it is kind of your ability to organize, sometimes more important than the strength of your army. If you're badly organized, it doesn't work, right? There's so many factors coming in there. Yeah. So militarily, probably Ajatasattu was probably stronger, but yeah. Yes. Okay, so now let us see what the Buddha has to say about this. Now the Venerable Ananda was standing behind the Lord, fanning him. And the Lord said, Ananda, have you heard that the Vajrayans hold regular and frequent assemblies? I have heard, Lord, that they do so. So I was just joking to the monks the other day. I was in the monastery, and because we have got air conditioning now in the main hall of the monastery. So I said, this is the precedent for having air conditioning in the main hall of the monastery. He was standing fanning the Buddha, right? The fanning is the original air conditioning, just like we have here. So this is how you make excuses, right? This was kind of the old-fashioned air conditioning. So now we have the... There they are over there. Yeah. Anyway, I'm just messing around a bit. So this is the first one, right? About frequent and regular assemblies. And then the Buddha says, Ananda, as long as the Vajrayans hold regular and frequent assemblies, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So this is the first one of these little factors. And so just the fact that you have regular assemblies, that you have you meet frequently, is actually enough to really to ensure your prosperity and that you don't actually decline. And of course, the idea here with these words, decline and prosperity, what we are talking about here, of course, is the general well-being of a country and a particular organization. So later on, we will see that this is also applied to Buddhism itself, to the Buddha, to the Sangha especially. So if you want to have a prosperous Sangha, again, there are certain qualities that are required for that Sangha and for Buddhism to last long into the future. And that's where it becomes particularly interesting for us. But here, just for a country itself, just the idea of having regular assemblies, right? Frequent assemblies is actually a very supporting factor for the strength of a country. And you can kind of imagine why that is the case, right? If you have regular assemblies, it means you get your differences ironed out. It means you have a better understanding of each other. It means you have more harmony, hopefully, within that community. It means that you can organize things. You can kind of make sure that everything is functioning properly. And you create a strong kind of sense of both bondage and commonality and understanding by having regular assemblies. It's like a country today. A country has a lot of things in common, right? That's what makes something a country. A language, a certain culture, and all of these kind of things. And here, you're actually creating that commonality through regular assemblies, etc. Right? To the extent that you are willing to, you know, go to war with each other. Your identity is so important to you in your country. I will go to war against these other, you know, these nasty barbarians next door. Right, like in Norway, the Swedes are the barbarians. So we say, oh, go to... I'm joking. Because it's always the country that is nearest to you is the one that you have the most arguments with, right? So in Norway, it's the Swedes. And it's always like that. Wherever you go in the world, it's always exactly the same. So regular assembly is already an important factor here to make sure you have that harmony and commonality here. Have you heard? So, good at the Buddhist society. Remember, these are rules, or these are principles, right, by which a society, whether it's a Buddhist society or a country or whatever it is, by which that society prospers. So, these are actually applicable to the Buddhist society as well. So, you have some from the committee over there. Good. So, you can listen to these things, right? This will strengthen the Buddhist society as well. So, keep these things in mind so they can be used anywhere. So then the second factor. Have you heard that the Vajrayans meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony? I have heard, Lord, that they do so. Ananda, as long as the Vajrayans meet in harmony, break up in harmony, and carry on their business in harmony, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. So here, what we are seeing, the crucial word in this little paragraph is the word which is here translated as harmony. And the Pali word is samagga. And this is a word that is, you find in Thai, samagi has a similar kind of meaning in Thai. In Sinhala, do you have the same word for harmony? Same word. Okay, same word. Yeah, because these are words that people use in Buddhist societies, right? Thailand, Sri Lanka, etc. But this word actually has two meanings in the Pali text. One meaning is that it means unity or unified, right? You are unified. In other words, the meaning there is that everybody is present at the meetings. Nobody is left out. So this is the first meaning of this word. And then from that meaning, you derive the secondary meaning, which is samagga, meaning harmony, everybody working together in a harmonious fashion. And from the monastic perspective, this idea that everybody has to be present, that is exactly how the monastic community works. You can only make a decision if the entire monastic community is there at the meeting. So if somebody wants to ordain, right, and one monk says, no, I don't want that monk to become a monk, that layperson to become a monk, then because everybody doesn't agree, that person cannot become a monk. Everybody has to agree. Decisions are made in unanimity. And this is one of those... So this, I think, is the root meaning here of this particular passage. Everybody should be present. Everybody who were expected, everybody who counted in that society. Of course, there were people who didn't really count, and I'm sure that was probably perhaps the majority of that society. But those who were considered like the core of that society, they all had to be present at these particular meetings. Right? And then you made decisions. Presumably, I think decisions then were made in exactly the same way they are made in the Sangha. Because that is why these Sangha rules, they are obviously descended from rules that existed in India at that time. So they also would have made decisions unanimously rather than by majority or whatever. And there's something very beautiful about that, very powerful about always having to have unanimous decisions. When you have a majority decisions, there will always be a certain degree of tyranny, the tyranny of the majority of the minority, right? The majority says, you must do this. I don't want to do this. You have to. The majority has voted this way. Okay, so there's always a degree of confrontation there, of violence almost, in that kind of situation. But if everybody has to come on board, it's a different kind of situation. It means that if somebody disagrees, right, or somebody has a different opinion, you have to talk to them, find out, what is your problem? Can we adjust our proposition? What will you be happy to go with a majority if everybody goes this way? So you have had more of a dialogue around these things. Everybody has to come on board. And then everybody gets some degree of satisfaction out of that decision. Nobody feels they have been trampled over, right? We don't care what you think. The majority says this. And it's very beautiful. And you may think that it doesn't work. You may think that this is crazy. This is like idealism gone completely over the top. Actually, it does work. If you have good leadership, leadership that is sensitive, leadership that knows how to talk to people in the right way, it actually works very well. Because this is exactly the way of decision-making we use at Bodhinyana Monastery here. We have a sangha of 20 fully ordained, depends a little bit on who was at the monastery, who was not there, between 15 and 20 fully ordained monks. And we're actually able to make decisions in that way. It may seem weird, it may seem completely impossible. Actually, it works if you are careful and sensitive to things. Of course, it depends on the maturity of people, it depends on people being reasonable, all that. But usually people, when they understand that they have a responsibility to make decisions come through, it actually works. So very, very nice. And maybe this is one thing we could do at the Buddhist Society, that everything has to be unanimous, that's going to work. Is that going to work, Cecilia? Is that the... You've been president before, maybe. So, anyway, just a possibility. And of course, from that, if you then act in this way, the idea is also then, from that comes harmony as well, right? If you act in this way, everybody is on board, then harmony also happens as a result. So you can see how these things then come together in a very nice way here. So if you meet together, nobody leaves during the meeting, you stay there, and then you all depart together afterwards. And you do this in a harmonious way. You iron out your differences. You make that society go forward. You make your decisions in this way. It strengthens that society. It strengthens that community. It strengthens whatever organization or institution that you want to talk about. Okay, next one. Have you heard that the Vajrayans do not authorize what has not been authorized and do not abolish what has been authorized, but proceed according to what has been authorized by the ancient tradition? I have, Lord. As long as they do this, they can be expected to prosper and not decline. Right? So this is another one, and interesting one, and it is one that may, again, I think it needs a little bit of interpretation, because I don't think it's possible to live with the same laws forever and ever after. Society changes, right? There are new things that come in, new ways of commerce that have to be ironed out, new ways of making contracts and making deals, and all of these kind of things are necessary. I don't think it means that you don't change anything, you don't add anything here. But I think there is a basic constitution, a basic legal framework that everybody agrees upon and everybody carries on with afterwards. I think this is what it means. It means that those basic laws, we are careful, we don't have too much hubris and start to say, yeah, these ancients, they didn't know what they were doing, right? We're going to change everything and make new laws. And then if you do that, very often a lot of that wisdom that was there perhaps in those ancient societies gets thrown out of the door at the same time. So you have a certain respect for tradition. And I think this is one of those very important things. We shouldn't always throw traditions out too easily here. So it's important to, I think, understand this in the right way. The basic laws, you leave them as they are, and you practice accordingly. But there is, of course, an overlay of new laws as well. And this is one of the very important principles in monasticism, in the Buddha's teachings. We'll have a look at that later on. The idea that you have the word of the Buddha, you have the rules and regulations laid down by the Buddha, and you practice in accordance with that, right? You don't change it. You don't do things in new ways. You don't think that you know much better than the Buddha. If you think that, it's quite possible that you will be on the wrong track, to say the least. Right? So this is, again, one of those things. A degree of humility, I suppose, and at the same time, a degree of appreciation of tradition and understandings of one's predecessors and wise people in the past. Okay. Next one. Have you heard that they honor, respect, revere, and salute the elders among them, and consider them worth listening to? Right? This is another kind of interesting one. And it sort of occurs, you know, this is obviously an eternal problem, right? This was there at the time of the Buddha. We know that this is a problem today as well, right? Sometimes, you know, you want to have all the youth comes on board, okay, kick out all the oldies. The oldies are kind of over the hill. They're not really useful anymore. So kind of we need that youthful energy. Forget about the wisdom that the older people may have accumulated. We want that youthful energy coming in. And it's very easy to forget about the kind of accumulated wisdom that is sometimes there in people who have lived longer. Important to have the qualifier sometimes, right? Sometimes you find older people who are just as foolish as anyone else. But okay, but sometimes older people have a certain wisdom that they have acquired through life. And this is something that they are saying here should be revered and should be honored. And this seems to be a staple of history. I remember it was Plato who also said, Plato, right, one of the greatest philosophers in the West, and he said something, wow, you know, when I look at the young generation, I see no future for the world. Everything is going to go downhill, right? It's exactly the same thing. It's a kind of eternal problem that we face in society. And the Buddha was already talking about these things back then, how important it is to have that sense of respect for the elder generation and the accumulated wisdom that they may have. And listen to them, right? Go to the elders, see what they have to say, and not dismiss it too quickly, but take it on board in the right way. And perhaps especially, I don't know, certainly Western society, that's the society I know the best. I think certainly these things are important reminders. And again, this is something we will also see in the monastic setting later on as well. Okay, next one. Have you heard that they honor, that they do not forcibly abduct others' wives and daughters and compel them to live with them? I have, Lord, and if you do this, then again you will prosper and not decline. So this particular passage is a little bit strange. It sounds very kind of violent, to be honest. I am not sure it is translated differently in different places. I think what this may be a reference to, may be a reference to the ancient Indian idea of arranged marriages, right? You have an arranged marriage, and when you have an arranged marriage, it's always the girl, it's always the woman that has to move from her family to the family of her, of the groom. So it's, and this is one of the specific sufferings of a woman of ancient India, was precisely that she was the one who was always taken from her family and had to go to her husband's family. And often they would be very young, right? They would probably still be very attached to the family. They would be in their teens or something, and they had to go to some other family, perhaps not even a very nice family, and they had to start living there. So I think it might be a reference to this, because otherwise it sounds kind of strange. Otherwise it sounds like you kind of go onto the street and just grab any woman. That's what it sounds like, which sounds a bit over the top. So the point here then would be that if there is an arranged marriage and it turns out that it's just not working, right? The girl, the bride or whatever really doesn't want to live with her new family, then it is wrong to kind of force her to do that against her wishes. So again, there's this idea of compassion, the idea of an overarching ethics which is higher than just the tradition in that society at the time. And I think one of the things that also is underlying here, and that we will see afterwards when we see how this is applied to the Sangha, the monastic community, is that you should have a limit on your desires. Right? You should limit your desires to a certain extent. If you allow all your desire just to run riot, and you pursue every desire you have, you end up with a very, very fragmented and very bad society, with a lot of crime, a lot of problems. In a society that is good, people need a certain amount of self-control to limit your desires, limit your ill will, and hold back on those things so that it doesn't destroy the fabric of society itself. And I know that there is quite a little bit of psychological research these days that shows that some of the people who are most successful in life, in kind of whatever area it might be, they very often are people who have precisely that ability. I think they call it like, what is the name for this again? The ability to put off the any kind of benefit that you get from something. What do they call that? Delay gratification. Okay, delay gratification is one of those. That ability to delay the gratification is one of the factors that point to whether somebody is going to be successful, better than almost any other factor, apparently. So it's one of those pointers is going on. And this, I think, is possibly partly what is going on here. So you can see it sort of fits, perhaps, with modern psychological ideas as well. Perhaps. I'm not sure if it is precisely that, but heading in the same direction anyway. Yes. Yeah. Yes, I think you probably are right. It's almost like a feminist idea, in a sense, right? It's kind of helping out the women to kind of live a better life, in a sense. So I think you may be right about that. But it's obviously, in this case, it's obviously fairly obvious dimension to ethics, because it's pretty, if what it says here is literally the case, then obviously it's pretty bad. But yes, indeed, and I think there are many things about the Buddha's teachings. I know that Ajahn Sujata, I think he may be a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but he says the Buddha was the first feminist. I don't know if that is maybe exaggerating things a little bit, but there are many things that the way he talks, where he wants to create a bit more equality for women in society, make the oppression a little bit less, right? And it obviously was much worse at that time than it is today. Okay. And the next one, it is that they honor, respect, revere, and salute the Vajrayan shrines in the city and outside the city, not withdrawing the proper support made and given before. So this is another interesting one, and again, you have to read a little bit into this, because it's not exactly obvious why this is so important, right? Why should this be something that helps the growth of the Vajrayans? Why is this something that hinders the decline of a society or a Buddhist community or whatever it is. Why is this so important? And I think the reason is because here we are kind of moving into the religious or the spiritual aspect of things. These shrines that existed in the forest, inside, it says abroad and at home here, but I think it means inside the city and outside the city. These were holy places at that time. Not holy places that belonged to any particular community. They didn't belong so much to the Buddhist or to anyone else. But they were general shrines that were available where people would go perhaps and they would often give offerings to the deities, right? That has happened in India, happens still in the present day, and it happened 2,500 years ago. So again, nothing has really changed in India. Still the same country. And so this is the spiritual aspect of things. And I think the idea here is that you should not forget the spiritual dimension of life. There is more to life than just material well-being. There's more to life than just living in harmony. There's a spiritual dimension to life. And that is, you remember that when you do little, even just little spiritual things, like going to shrines like that. And when you go to these shrines, very often there would be maybe ascetics there, there would be Buddhist monks there, Buddhist nuns perhaps, Brahmins, religious people, because they would often stay at those shrines. And then because they would be in the forest, right? And then of course you would meet these people and you might have a conversation with them. They might give you a teaching and you would get some spiritual input in return just for supporting these shrines, as has been the traditions of the Vajrayans for a long time. So here I think we're moving into the spiritual dimension of things and not forgetting that aspect of life. Sometimes you need somebody who has stepped out of society to be able to understand society properly. Just like the fish in water, you can't really understand it while you're in there. Somebody who steps outside often has a better perspective of what is going on. So you go to the Buddha. This is why you go to the Buddha, right? To ask about mundane things. Because he has a better perspective also on those things. And this is why what is so powerful about this idea of stepping outside in this way here. So I think this is what is happening here. So you keep on doing that to make sure that you have that input in your society. It makes for a stronger society when you do that. There's actually quite interesting. This is found in other suttas as well, and these are some of the suttas that talk about the Chakravarti, which are the wheel-turning monarchs. The wheel-turning monarchs is some kind of mythological monarch in India, which ran society based on Dhamma principles alone, right? Through kindness, through generosity. If people were poor, you helped them, right? So they didn't have to steal and all of these kind of things. And one of those principles in that Dhammachakka, Chakravarti Raja, one of the principles of those righteous Dhamma kings, that's what it means, is that they should go every now and again to the ascetics, to the Brahmins, and ask them, how is this? How am I supposed to understand this situation? What should I do in this difficult, complicated, apparently paradoxical situation? And by going to them, you resolve issues in a way that accords with prosperity for that society instead of actually causing decline and trouble. This is something that goes through the suttas again. The spiritual input is very important in secular society as well. And this is why I think it is great that we have, you know, Buddhist society here. You have Ajahn Brahm sitting on the committee, right? I don't know if he... Does he give much spiritual input? But I think it's kind of, it happens naturally, right? It just happens. Ajahn Brahm and Venerable Hasapanya are there. It makes it more, hopefully, a more kind of directed in that way. And I think really our whole societies need that. We need more of this kind of direction. And it's very useful for society at large as well. So something to keep in mind. Yes, please. I think there are fairy tales. I think there are mostly legends. A legend is not, or a mythology is not necessarily completely a fairy tale. There is maybe some core truth to it. But I don't think they're not historical personalities. it's not based on history. It's not they're not historical personal. They're actually stories probably taken from the larger context of Indian society and then used in the Buddhist context as a consequence. But there's no historical evidence that such kings ever existed in India. Sorry? Right. Yeah. Exactly, and because India didn't really exist before Ashoka. Before Ashoka, there were just tiny little kingdoms, right? So it doesn't really fit with the whole Indian context. But there is apparently some precedence for the Chakravarti Raja in the some of the Brahmanical suttas and the kind of the Hindu system. They have some stories about a similar kind of kings. There seems to be some kind of connection there between the Buddhist ones and the broader Indian view of these things. So that may be where it comes from. With Buddhist flavor, right? Yeah, sure. And often that's what happens. Mythologies are stories that come from the distant past that have been distorted over time. They don't really kind of correspond to any actual historical reality, but there is, but roughly to some historical reality that may have existed before, that may come from that. Yeah. I think it's a mixture perhaps of historical and kind of evolution of those stories over time. Yeah. That would be my guess. I know Sujata is really good on myth. He's kind of he loves mythology and stuff, so he can kind of probably tell you much more about that if you're interested here. Okay, come to the last one of these seven, how to run the Vajrayana Republic in a good way. And the last one is as follows, have you heard, Ananda, that the Vajrayans make proper provisions is made for the safety of arahants, so that such arahants may come in future to live there, and those already there may dwell in comfort. I have, Lord, Ananda, as long as the Vajrayans make these provisions, proper provisions for the safety of arahants, so that such arahants may come in future to live there, they may be expected to prosper and not decline. Right? So get some arahants into your country. It's always good. So any organization will surely prosper from having some arahants there. And again, of course, now we are taking this idea of spirituality even one step further, right? And here it is specifically the idea that you want spiritual people, especially those that are worthy of respect, you want them in your country. You specifically want them to be there. Because if they are available, you have a resource that is extraordinarily powerful for your country to draw on. And if you use that resource in the right way, you get a very... You use these insights of these arahants to kind of run your country in the right way. So again, it's the same kind of thing, right? And we should do the same thing here in the Buddhist society. We should make sure that the arahants are happy here, right? So whenever you see arahants coming here, you should say, "Oh, venerable sir, venerable sister, please come. You know, we want more people like you. Please come in here." And to always to be friendly and kind and helpful to those people we really respect, because sometimes it's hard to overestimate the impact one person who has a very profound understanding of the nature of reality and has deep insight into things, the profound effect they have on the Buddhist society, they have on the general Buddhist community around you and the whole country as a whole. It's very, very important impact, and we forget that. And sometimes I'm embarrassed. Sometimes I feel I don't treat Ajahn Brahm well enough. And I think, how can I improve my treatment of Ajahn Brahm so I can kind of make sure he doesn't kind of go off in a cave of his own, just disappears one day. He would love that, right? If he had the chance, he would never even turn back. He would just go into the cave and he would stay there for the rest of his life. So the only way if we're going to make him stay, please be kind to him, right? Every one of us, let's be nice so we can hang around for a long, long time into the future. Then we will have a very prosperous and good Buddhist society as a consequence. This is the way to do it. When we do that in the right way, then things will happen as a consequence. Very important point, right? Not to be underestimated. Now, one of the things you may wonder about here, now the Buddha is telling these Vajrayans, make sure that you make provisions for the safety of the arahants. What do the Vajrayans know about arahants? Right? How can the Buddha say, look after the arahants? How are the Vajrayans going to recognize an arahant? Who can recognize arahants anyway? It's pretty hard to know, right? Who are the arahants in the world? And these were Vajrayans. Many of them wouldn't even have been Buddhists. So how can you recognize an arahant if you're not even a Buddhist? You don't even understand what the idea is about. And so the point here, I think, is not so much that you actually invite arahants as such. If you do, it's great, of course, because it's wonderful to have arahants around. But the idea is that you invite spiritual people who are generally respected for their wonderful and powerful qualities. Some of those may turn out to be arahants. Some may turn out to be scallywags, right? And not the real deal. But generally, you invite those people who have those spiritual qualities that generally were recognized as arahants at that time. Maybe not just Buddhists, maybe even people from different religions, because he's talking to a society that was not Buddhist, but that was a society that had many different religions in it, and the word arahant was a word in general use in that society, and it meant anyone who was respected by that society. So you invite those, right? And this is the right approach. Don't try to figure out who the arahants are, because you're going to spend the rest of your life doing just that, and you will never really invite anyone. Just see, okay, who is to be respected for their spirituality, for their practice, for the way they are? These are the people we should support. These are the people we should look after. And then we will have a strong Buddhist community, strong Buddhist society, strong Bodhinyana monastery, strong Dhammasara monastery, and hope perhaps even a stronger, broader community in Western Australia as well as a consequence. And that, I think, is what is actually meant here, rather than arahants as such, because that is impossible to really know for certain. Okay, then the Buddha says, I'm going to only continue for one or two more minutes because I'm going for a long time already. Then the Lord said to the Brahmin Vasakara, once Brahmin, when I was at the Sarandada shrine in Vaisali, I taught the Vajrayans these seven principles for preventing decline. And as long as they keep to these seven principles, as long as these principles remain in force, the Vajrayans may be expected to prosper and not decline. So here he is saying that he actually has himself personally taught these things to these Vajrayans, right? And these are the things that will hold the country together and will make them strong and perhaps even prevent the prevent wars perhaps even and difficult things to happen. Anyway, that is an hour and a half, and I don't have much more juice myself, so I'm going to have to stop there. And some of the things that come afterwards are very inspiring, and hopefully it will not be too long before I return to Dhammaloka. So if you're interested in this kind of things, please come to the next one of these ones. Otherwise, you can listen to it online, and we will continue this over the next few months or whatever. Are there any last questions before we call it a day? Huitong, yeah? Do you want to take the microphone, Huitong? It's behind you, yeah?
Just to consolidate the understanding, you mentioned interestingly earlier about King Bimbisara.
Yeah.
Obviously, he was responsible for some of the annexation of other regions as well. So in terms of timeline, just in terms of a personal understanding, so he was, typically understood to be a stream enterer.
Yeah.
So can we confidently place the timeline that he entered the stream only after the annexation?
I would think so, because King Bimbisara is a very peripheral figure in the suttas. He only occurs in a very few suttas. His King Adatasattu is much more central. We see him much more often. So he's almost forgotten in the fog of history, in a sense. So I think it was only the very first few years of the Buddha's life that he was around, and he disappeared quickly after that. So I think he was already quite old at that stage, probably, when the Buddha started teaching him and he became, a stream mentor or whatever. So I think it's quite likely that the annexation and the wars that he may have done happened before that. I think that's fairly, that would be my guess. That is what it looks like, I would say. Yeah.
Because interestingly, the King Bimbisara is a very inspiring figure, at least in my upbringing. He kind of said, what an ideal king could behave. The way he treated his son was exceptional. Knowingly that the son was trying to kill him, that he was so benevolent, so loving. That was exceptional. So I thought it's interesting to say he's kind of a side figure, but to me, he seems like a central figure, at least in the education of kingship.
That's true. I would agree with you. He is very, very inspiring. But it's a little bit difficult for King Bimbisara to tease out the historical person from the legendary person, precisely because most of the information we have about him is from much later sources and things. So it's a little bit difficult to know. But I would agree with you. He is in many ways very inspiring and inspirational kind of character, certainly the way he's portrayed. So, yeah, that is true. So, but you know what? It's difficult to be king, right? You have to do all these things. There was a nice sutta in the... Where is that? That's in the... somewhere in the Sanyutta Nikaya, I think. And the Buddha is thinking to himself. He's thinking, if I were to be a king, I think it's before he becomes a Buddha or whatever, is it possible to rule a country without any kind of force or violence? This is the thought in the Buddha's mind. And he never answers the question. He just asks the question. It kind of left hanging in the air. Like suspense, right? No answer. And I think it's a part of the problem of being a king. It's almost impossible, probably, to actually rule a country without any kind. There's so much forces that kind of push you towards violence and all of these kind of things. Sounds like a lousy job. Yeah, I think that's very true, actually. Very miserable job, yeah. Anybody else would like to say anything? Everybody? Lynn at the back,
So, Ajahn, could these principles be applied like to a family group?
I would say so, yes. I think these are, probably any kind of like social institution, any kind of social grouping. This principle, I think, would probably be useful. I haven't really thought about it. I haven't really tried to apply each one of these to see how they would go, but I would think so. Yeah, you would like to have arahants come into your house every now and again, right? So you invite them in and you would... come to the Buddhist site, they bow down to the Buddhist site, that's like going to the shrines. So, I think probably, Okay, anyone else like to say anything? Everybody happy? Everybody supremely happy, supremely exhausted or whatever it is? Anyway, okay, so that's wonderful. So thanks all for coming. So let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.